Ladies and gentlemen, we are now beginning the conference call. If you get disconnected during the conference, please call 1-888-409-6709. Again, the number to get reconnected is 1-888-409-6709. At this time, your line is muted and will continue to remain muted during the duration of the call. To ask a question or if you have a comment, please press star 1. If at any time during the conference you need assistance, please press star 0. I would now like to introduce Jocelyn, Grassroots Manager for Grassroots Poverty Campaign.
Good afternoon, everybody, or good morning, depending on where you are. Welcome to the November 2014 Results U.S. Poverty National Conference call, our post-election version of the call. We're glad that you could join us this, join us today. I want to remind you before we get started that if you would like to view the conference call slides for today's call, you can go to the results homepage, and in the Take Action box, which is at the top right-hand corner, just click the link, and that will download the slides for you, and you can follow along. So before we get started with the call, first thing I want to do is thank everybody who really worked hard in trying to reach out to candidates last month so that you could start introducing results and some of our issues to folks that, you know, maybe got elected or maybe get elected in the future. And appreciate you doing that. And we will have actually some shares later on in the call where you can hear where some groups did that and hear how it went. But also want to thank you. And if you're following on this, in the PowerPoint, you can go down a few slides past the second slide after Meredith's picture. You'll see we also want to thank you for all the great work that you've done this year in reaching out to members of Congress and getting media published. So far this year, we've generated at least 92 media pieces to support our U.S. poverty campaigns, which is, an excellent amount, not as well as last year, but we focused a little bit more on the face-to-face meetings this year than media, but it's still a great success so far, and we'll get some more this month based on the action, which I'll go over in a few minutes. But also, the wonderful work you've done in reaching out to members of Congress. You know, we have had 119 meetings with members of Congress, and that's with at least 50 different representatives and 26 different senators. This is by far the most amount of face-to-face meetings we've had in any year in recent memory. We've already exceeded last year's goal by almost 30 meetings. So, again, thank you so much for the work that you're doing, and hopefully, and the good thing is we still got 2 months left in the year, so we may even add to that total over the next couple of months. So thank you again, and so now what we're going to do is we're going to jump right in the call, briefly run over the agenda for today's call. I'm going to start off the call by going through the November action and our monthly training, and I'm just doing that because our guest speaker was a little delayed, and so we're going to
push it back. I'm here.
Oh, you're here. Okay, great. Wonderful. Well, then we'll go ahead and jump right into to our guest speaker. So thank you, Mr. Bernstein, for being on the call today. So let me brief run through the agenda again. We have guest Bernstein will start here in just a few minutes. Then we'll do the November action overview and monthly training, our roll call. We'll have some shares about candidate outreach and then close the call off with a fundraising announcement and announcements. So let me go ahead and start by introducing our guest, and I can say personally I'm thrilled that the Jared Bernstein can be on our call today. I've read many of his things and heard him talk on the radio and on television, and so it's great to have him here today. So just a brief introduction, Jared Bernstein is currently a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, and with his areas of expertise, including federal and state and economic and fiscal policies, income inequality and mobility, trends in employment and earnings, international comparisons, and the analysis of financial and housing markets. Before joining this center from 2009 to 2011, he was the chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, executive director of the White House Task Force on the Middle Class, and a member of President Obama's economic team. Prior to joining the Obama administration, Mr. Bernstein was a senior economist and the director of living standards program at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C., and he was also the deputy chief economist at the U.S. Department of Labor in the mid-1990s. He is the author and co-author of numerous books, including Crunch, Why Do I Feel So Squeezed, and 9 editions of The State of Working America. He's also been published extensively in different venues like the New York Times, Washington Post, which was actually published in yesterday, and the Financial Times, and has also spoken on cable stations like CNBC and MSNBC, CNBC and MSNBC, as well as NPR. He also contributes to the New York Times Economics blog and hosts the Jared Bernstein blog at www.jaredbernsteinblog.com. And he holds a PhD in social welfare from Columbia University. Mr. Bernstein, welcome to the Results National Conference call.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm glad to be here.
Wonderful. So, first off, you know, as you know, or may know, Results and many others have been pushing Congress to protect and strengthen the earned income tax credit and the child tax credit over the last couple of years, and in particular trying to make the ERA improvements permanent. Now that the election is done, you know, what do you see Congress doing in the lame duck session, and are there any opportunities for us to move any anti-poverty policies forward, especially making those improvements permanent?
Well, it's a great and an important question, and while clearly the alignment of the Congress shifted in a way that makes a question like that harder, I think there are some useful things to talk about. I'll get into that in a second, but first I want to just say how pleased I am to be able to share the call with Results, because you folks are aptly named. It's hard for me to think of a group who's gotten more results in key areas, often in climates like the current one, that are very tough. So whenever someone tells me about a rabbit that's been pulled out of a hat in our world, I think, aha, I'll bet Results fingerprints are on that somewhere. So I thank you for your work, and I'm pleased to be here. Well, look, there are a couple of budget issues that are to which myself and my colleagues are paying attention in the near term. And that is the continuing resolution, that is the federal government needs to be funded when the current budget runs out on December 11th, and a set of tax extenders, that is extension of a bunch of tax bills that expired at the end of last year. Now, obviously, the budget has great bearing on low-income programs. Why are tax extenders important? I mean, to low-income people, a lot of those things are research and development credits or depreciation, things that apply to businesses. I'll speak to that in a second. Actually, it has direct bearing on what I think you called in the question, the ARRA refundables, and this is the idea that both the earned income credit and the child tax credit were extended in important and useful and anti-poverty ways that have helped low-income people, but they're scheduled to expire at the end of 2017. The continuing resolution, I won't say much about that. I think the idea there is that what's important there is that the congressional leadership would, the current Congress, the folks who are still there until the next Congress convenes in January, they'd like to nail down a year-long CR at current levels, so not much changes in our world. But I think what's worrisome, the thing to look out for there, is an idea I've heard among some Republicans that what they'd really like is a very short CR just to get past the December 11th deadline and allow the new Congress to get involved in crafting a different budget resolution. And based on the composition of the new Congress and what I think some of their priorities will be in low-income areas, I would consider that to be a worrisome and a less desirable outcome than a longer-term CR. So that's kind of one potential threat out there that I wanted to tell folks on the call about. I think the more kind of germane story here has to do with the tax extenders deal, where there could be some traction for horse trading as regards the refundables, the RRA refundables. Now, this is tricky, and I'm going to get into a little bit of the weeds, and then I'll stop. I don't want to belabor this question too far. But you know, when it comes to extending tax policy, especially making permanent extensions, which is what Republicans in particular want to do with this somewhat large group of tax breaks, largely for businesses that get extended year in and year out, is to permanently extend these tax policies without any pay-fors. That is to essentially put them in the baseline in terms of permanent tax policy, but without paying for them, and basically kind of dam the deficit full speed ahead. So the righteous fiscal place to be, as we've argued at the Center on Budget, is not to do that, because we're talking about adding, you know, hundreds of billions to the deficit. And in fact, if you were to permanently extend these tax breaks without paying for them, you'd end up canceling just about three-quarters of the savings that we achieved in the fiscal cliff deal, the budgetary savings. So we would view that as a uniquely fiscally irresponsible thing to do. It's also worrisome, by the way, and I'm going to talk a little bit later perhaps about potential for tax reform, that if you make these extenders permanent and you put them in the baseline unpaid for, that means that you won't have to offset their cost when you're doing a future tax reform. That is, in order to achieve a revenue-neutral tax reform, it'll be a lot cheaper for you because you're taking out the cost of paying for all these tax cuts. So it's actually a pretty fiscally irresponsible direction to go in. Now, if you let's hold that thought in your head and think about the following. The extended EITC and CTC, and I suspect I don't have to go through how these programs work to the folks on this call, but these improvements in the case of the child tax credit, a much lower threshold above which you start earning the credit, moved down from what would have been around $12,000 to around $3,000, so that helped a lot of very low-income people start getting that credit up to $1,000 per kid. The EITC, we got rid of reduced the marriage penalty and increased benefits for families with three or more kids. Those are the IRA refundables. And if they were to expire on schedule at the end of 2017, it would have a very negative effect on low and moderate-income families. 12 million people, including 7 million kids, would be pushed into poverty. A mom with two kids working full-time at the current minimum wage would lose about $1,700 a year just by dint of losing her CTC. The marriage penalty would come back, and families with more kids, three or more kids, would lose the EITC. So absent action on this expiration, the anti-poverty effects of these measures would be significantly reduced. So here's the punchline. Two can play this extension game. As I've stressed, it's much preferable to pay for any tax extension that are made permanent. However, in the hurly-burly of the politics that are coming, if legislators want to argue for a permanent unpaid-for extension of these extenders, then we should push very hard for a permanent extension of the IRA refundables as well. So this is kind of at the intersection of threat and opportunity. If they want to really cancel three-quarters of the fiscal cliff savings, we're not at all happy about that. But in the interest of fairness, in the interest of parity, we ought to also permanently extend the refundable credits.
Great. Thanks so much. And appreciate that that analysis of it. And that's kind of what we've been thinking as well, and appreciate you sharing that with our volunteers. So looking past the lame duck when the new Congress comes in, you know, and looking at the outcome of the election, you know, what opportunities and threats do you see over the next 2 years with regard to programs that are helping and serving low-income Americans? You know, what do you see happening with those?
Well, again, you're asking me hard questions, but that's okay. These are tough times for folks in our business. I would say let's talk about the threats first, because they're more pronounced. I would say they come in two flavors, the threats of bad actions and the threats of inaction. In terms of actions that could be taken that would be pose specific threats to low-income programs, of course, the idea of block granting SNAP, formerly food stamps, is out there, along with pretty much every other bad idea that you saw in the Farm Bill debate as regards SNAP. Those ideas haven't gone away. But I would say the one that I've heard raised most among conservatives, and certainly Paul Ryan comes to mind, has been block granting SNAP, which would be a terrible idea for a lot of reasons. First of all, if you want to see the impact, if you want to see the impact of block granting a low-income program in terms of reducing its anti-poverty effectiveness, you have to look no further than TANF, where TANF's counter-cyclical or anti-poverty function was massively diminished by changing it into a block grant, and I have no reason to think the same thing wouldn't happen with SNAP. Secondly, once you block grant these programs, it becomes a lot easier to start cutting them and imposing draconian eligibility requirements. Now, in a similar spirit, while there may not be so much talk of block granting Medicaid, there's a kind of an ersatz or pseudo block grant on the agenda, which is a per capita cap for Medicaid, which has a similar impact. And I would alert folks in terms of the threat to that as well. Disability insurance, Social Security disability insurance. Solvency issues will be debated within the next 2 years because the program faces that problem. And we've written extensively at the center on ways to solve that without lowering benefits or hurting the eligibility of those who ought to be able to get on the rolls. More cuts to non-defense discretionary. Many of those programs speak right to the areas we're trying to help. Below sequester levels, there's no reason why they can't go below the sequester levels if they can get the votes, and I think that would be damaging because they're already too low. Taking from non-defense discretionary to boost defense, breaking that firewall, that's a threat. Threats to the Affordable Care Act in ways that I won't go into now. But can if you'd like. There's the potential for regressive tax reform, that is tax reform that is more based on sort of supply-side trickle-down ideas that would make it both more difficult for us to generate the revenues we need and would generate higher after-tax inequality. And then there's increasingly been talk of a balanced budget amendment and passing a resolution to have a constitutional convention wherein a balanced budget amendment would be ratified by states. It sounds like a crazy idea, but it's percolating out there, and it would be, again, a surefire way to seriously starve our programs for oxygen. So that's all the threats from action. Then there are threats from inaction. Resistance to raising the minimum wage, the federal minimum wage, although states have certainly been taking that on for themselves, including red states. Inaction on infrastructure. We talked about the RR refundables. Now, one of the things you see a lot in Washington is just legislators sitting on their hands, not doing anything, and letting things they don't like expire. So a real threat of inaction over the next few years, it's not till the end of 2017, but still, would be the expiration of the RR refundables we just discussed. Immigration reform, not acting on that is a threat, although I do think the president will act if Congress doesn't. And, of course, just letting sequestration bounce back in 2016 and stay in effect till 21, that's another one. Now, on the opportunity side, you asked me about threats and opportunities. There's more threats than opportunities. But on the opportunity side, it's not inconceivable that they could come together on an infrastructure investment program, and I think some of the benefits would redound to low-income workers. There's a discussion of corporate tax reform, which I only raise not because it helps low-income people, but because in the president's plan for corporate tax reform, there's a significant one-time savings that are then invested in infrastructure. You never know on the minimum wage. The policies can surprise you. We could end up with a minimum wage, although there'd probably be some very ugly horses traded for it. And then finally, there's been some bipartisan interest in expanding the childless part of the earned income credit, as well as some energy, as we saw with Patty Murray and Paul Ryan's bill from a year or so ago, to replace the sequester and at least temporarily reduce its negative impacts.
Thanks so much. It's certainly a lot to digest, but it's certainly good for us to get a kind of lay of the land. So, you know, looking ahead to the lame duck as well as, you know, when the new Congress comes in, you know, what things can grassroots advocates like Results and other groups out there do to help kind of break through this gridlock that currently plagues Congress and actually get some kind of meaningful policy passed in the next few years?
Well, hard question number three, because, you know, if enacting good policy was hard before last week, it's harder now. So as I've stressed, much of what we are thinking about is kind of being in protection mode, putting out fires, trying to prevent bad things like the expiration of the refundables from occurring. I think it's worth remembering, if you're feeling gloomy about these possibilities, that the threats that I've mentioned, they still need 60 votes in the Senate to get there. The president, I believe, will find his veto pen, and they're not going to have 60 votes. So the pressures that Results has historically been, I think, very effective in putting on legislators around these issues have become even more important. So certainly blocking all of those threats of action and inaction that I elaborated in my last answer would be relevant. I guess I would say that in terms of things advocates can do, I think it's actually helpful. I know we're always talking about the national story, or at least we're often talking about the national story on this call. I mean, I think it's actually relevant to think sub-nationally. Imagine Washington is, you know, pretty much locked down for the next couple of years. There's governors, white, you know, red, blue, purple governors, they have to do things. They have states. They have university systems. They have roads. They have schools. So they can't do the ideological gridlock the same way that members in D.C. can. And I've seen interesting things happening. In red states, we just mentioned the minimum wage. You know, higher minimum wage in Arkansas and in North Dakota, Nebraska. I wouldn't have believed that if you told me that was going to pass even 6 months ago. There's very interesting infrastructure ideas I've seen implemented at the state level. The Port of Cleveland, for example, has been dug out an interesting project. There's even immigration, I think, positive immigration actions that could be taken at the subnational level, part of which are just more welcoming kinds of policies. But I think that a subnational focus is also germane. And then two other things, and then I'll stop. One is, remember, this potential for a constitutional convention to secure a balanced budget amendment, that's a state legislature initiative. That has to be that's something that state these very conservative state legislatures are moving on. So when we're thinking subnational, I gave you some ideas, I think, about positive policies in that space. It's also very important to block state legislatures who are trying to convene this kind of a constitutional convention to enforce a balanced budget amendment. And finally, I guess there's just one broad overview thing. You know, really a lot of my work is on broad economic issues, the macroeconomy and inequality and the extent to which economic growth is failing to reach folks at the bottom of the pay scale. And a broad concern I have as the economy recovers, I mean, you can see it in the business press, you can hear it in the media, you know, you're getting one, you know, good word after another, GDP continues to grow. The Federal Reserve is talking about withdrawing their monetary support for the economy. And so I think there's a sense that the economy is returning to normal. And in a way it is, in a macroeconomic way, it kind of is. The stock market's been doing great, corporate profitability is through the roof. But we know that the poor, the near poor, even the middle class are still struggling. I mean, GDP is up 12%, corporate profits are up 45%, the stock market's almost double. Median household income is down in real terms, 3%, and you know, poverty is still 14-15%, and I think it's it won't be a surprise to people on this call the extent to which this macroeconomic growth is really failing to reach those at the bottom. So I think we also have to be mindful of not accepting that the economic recovery is somehow all well and good, and that the Federal Reserve can peel back, or that we don't need to be as vigilant as ever about all the things I've talked about in the course of our discussion.
Great, thank you so much. That's a good final point to remember about the economy. So now I'd like to give our volunteers a few minutes a chance to ask questions if they have any for you. So our volunteers out there, if you just press star one, it'll put you into the queue, and you can ask a question to Mr. Bernstein. So again, just push star one on your phone, and I'll put you in the queue. So we'll give you 10 seconds, and then Jenny, let us know if there's anybody in there.
You have a question from Columbus.
Okay, go ahead, Columbus.
Hi there. This is from one of our guests. What does the Obama administration mean by the, quote, American job, since the definition has implications for availability and worker income and for poverty and inequality?
Well, hello, Columbus, as opposed to
goodbye,
Columbus. well, I'm not sure exactly what the Obama administration means by American job, other than jobs for Americans. I think this gets to the comments that I made at the end of my conversation, which was you will hear the president himself, and he was saying this yesterday, and I completely agree with him and support his assertions when he says we've had job growth for 56 months in a row, we've added over 10 million jobs in the private sector, the unemployment rate is falling. All of that is true, and yet, as I've mentioned, there are still far too many people from the middle class on down struggling and not feeling the benefits of this growth. So when we talk about the American job, it's very important in my mind to be pretty specific and pretty granular. You know, these days when reporters call me and ask me about the economy, as they often do, my first thought is, okay, whose economy are you talking about? Because there are numerous different economies out there. And when I think about the American job or the American worker, frankly, I'm not thinking about the investment banker on Wall Street who's actually doing pretty well. I'm thinking about the production worker, the blue-collar worker who is facing a much tougher job market. In that regard, I mentioned infrastructure investment as an important initiative that I think would help provide more opportunities for the kinds of workers I think about when I think about American jobs. I think about doing something about the trade deficit. Ohio is a good example of a state that's, I think, trying to rebuild its manufacturing sector. We have to lower the trade deficit in that regard, and I've been thinking and writing about that if people want to follow up. We have to pursue much tighter labor markets. 5.8 or 5.9 isn't good enough. Neither is 5.5. We have to get the unemployment rate down very low and keep it there if we want the benefits of growth to begin to reach the middle class, much less the poor. So those are some agenda items that I think of when you raise those issues.
Great. Thanks so much, Columbus. Jenny, any other folks in the queue?
Yes, the next question is from Washington.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Bernstein. In terms of priorities, I don't know if you would know this or not. Head Start and Early Head Start, is there a deadline for December 16th for doing something on this? And the second point, isn't it true when we talk to our representatives that most economists now say that due to the studies over the last 20 years, raising the minimum wage has had little or no effect on increasing unemployment?
Let me start with the second question, a very important question, and I'm glad you raised it. I should have referenced that myself. That is exactly right. You've just done a very nice, tight summary of a couple of decades worth of literature. Here's the way I would summarize, you know, literally hundreds of papers on this issue. And by the way, one of the reasons we can actually be more confident about this finding than a lot of other economics findings is because we've had so many natural experiments. That is, by dint of all these state-level and even sub-state level cities and counties raising their own minimum wages, you have a kind of natural experiment where you can look at the impact of a minimum wage increase in place A relative to place B that looks a lot like place A economically but didn't raise the minimum wage. And you can compare the outcomes across place like that or across time. And what this high-quality research shows is that moderate increases in the minimum wage very much have their intended effect. They raise the pay of low-wage workers without doing much to diminish their job opportunities. Now, I don't think it's correct or fair to say that you can raise the minimum wage as high as you want, never have to worry about job loss. And in fact, the Congressional Budget Office did a study where they estimated that if the minimum wage were increased to 10-10 over 3 years, that's the federal plan that has been put forth, that the increase would reach 24.5 million workers. It would raise the pay of 24.5 million workers and lead to job losses of 500,000 workers. That means 49 workers would benefit for everyone who lost. And since there's a lot of churn in the low-wage job market, anyone who loses their job there would likely find a new job pretty quickly, and it would be a better job by dint of the higher wage. So I think that this research has really kind of gotten into the ether, and I suspect that's one reason why we saw these increases in red states, even while the usual opposition was out in full force against them. I don't know about any deadlines in Head Start or early Head Start, other than these are programs on the non-defense discretionary side of the ledger. So we have to be all of the concerns I raised about NDD spending and sequestration, which is very much a budget cap on that part of discretionary spending, are germane in that regard.
Great. Thanks so much, Bill. We'll try if we have time for maybe one more question. Is anyone in the queue, Jenny?
Yes. The next question is from Minneapolis.
Go ahead, Paul. Quickly, please.
Sure. The Democratic challenger in my local area agreed with the incumbent representative that we needed to reduce corporate taxes to discourage offshore movements by American corporations. Any comment on that?
Very much so. And by the way, I've written pretty extensively about that, as have some of my Center on Budget colleagues. So if you want to follow up, I can provide links to my result friends. I think that's largely a ruse. I don't believe from my studies of the motivations for firms offshoring, or the technical term is inverting, meaning just moving their tax mailbox to another country. They maintain their business structure here, but they move their tax liability to some low tax haven. They're not motivated by anything like a lower tax rate that we could conceivably legislate here. That is, if you look at the tax rates of places where they're going, they're you know, in the low double digits or single digits. You're talking about, you know, 10-12% or even lower. So, and by the way, some of these companies, if you look at their effective tax rate, what they actually pay, they're already paying 10-6% of their profits in taxes. And this applies specifically to multinational companies. In fact, companies who don't have multinational foreign operations typically face considerably higher effective tax rates. So I'm telling you that the motivation for this offshoring and these inversions is tax avoidance. And while it will diminish tax avoidance motivation slightly if you take the rate down from 35 to something realistic, like 28 is the president's tax rate for corporations, 28%. Maybe if you could really juice it down and close a lot of loopholes, you could get down lower. You're not going to get anywhere near the 12% Irish rate, for example. So I would argue that we shouldn't be moved by that argument. Now, that doesn't mean that we couldn't benefit from corporate tax reform, but I don't think we're going to really do much to block that kind of avoidance by taking the rate down a few points.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Paul. And unfortunately, we run out of time, but Mr. Burstein, thank you so much for being on our call today. It's a pleasure for me personally, and I know for our volunteer network, for you to share these very important insights and analyses of what we're looking ahead, and certainly appreciate all the great work that you do and all the great work that the Center on Budget does. And we look forward to continuing to work with you and with the Center on making these issues a priority in Congress.
My pleasure, and keep up the great work, results.
All right. Thank you. So now, folks, I'm going to turn it over to our Director of Domestic Campaign, Director of U.S. Poverty Campaigns, Meredith Dotson, to run through our action section really quick. Meredith, you there?
Yep, I am. Josh, can you hear me?
Yep, go ahead.
Okay, my apologies, folks. I am battling a bit of a cold, but we want to just briefly remind you about the focus of our action now that the election is over. So we've seen time and time again that really when there's a sense of a groundswell of folks across the country speaking out in the media, that really shapes the conversation in Washington, D.C. That was true last year when many of you did fabulous media work to push back against deep cuts to the SNAP, our food stamp program. And that's also going to be true as we look to impact and really shape tax policy priorities and make sure that the priority is put on, the tax credits that really are helping low-income working families make ends meet. So during this lame duck session, now that the election is over, our focus is folks generating letters to the editor across the country. You can see on slide 6 some of the basic kind of talking points, like a quick outline for your letter to the editor. First, you'll want to find a hook. Obviously, anything about the election or what Congress is going to be doing when they come back this coming week is a great hook for a letter. And then you can, of course, tie it into the fact that they're going to be one of the unfinished pieces of business is tax legislation, and really point out what's at stake in terms of that this is about the several expensive corporate tax breaks or expensive tax breaks for wealthy individuals that will add to the federal budget deficit. And then pivot on that to flag for readers that there are smarter policies that Congress should focus their energies on. And that's where you can really talk about the impact of the EITC and the child tax credit. These are, again, our nation's most successful anti-poverty programs for children. And I want to just build on one point that Jared made. So the inside baseball conversation around, well, if they're going to do something on corporate taxes, so, tit for tat, they should do something about EITC or CTC, that is not a public message. So I urge you very deliberately when you're writing your letters to the editor, you can talk about, hey, they're going to be, they're considering really expensive tax giveaways for corporations and wealthy families, but don't kind of endorse that that's okay as long as they do the EITC or CTC. Instead, just say, no, we got to focus on something else, and what we really need to focus on are these kind of smart policies that are lifting millions out of poverty. So hopefully that distinction's clear. We don't want to kind of basically endorse, like, oh, okay, extending a bunch of expensive corporate tax breaks are fine as long as they do this other thing. You do not want to make that point. I would suggest that you also don't want to make that point in conversations with most congressional offices. And some of the specific things you might want to mention about the EITC is that these programs are really very successful programs that are hand up, not a handout. So you can see some specifics on slide 7. There's really powerful data you can reference about the impact on kids whose families are getting the EITC, TC, and CTC, including how much money they earn later in life, and also how much they really incentivize work and prioritize families. So, and then it's important to note that some important provisions are set to expire. So the final piece is you're writing letters to the editor, and this is going to be, you know, especially true in, you know, in the context of an election, but really all the time, is include the name of your member of Congress specifically in your letter to the editor. They have staff members in Washington, D.C. literally, you know, go through and clip anything that has their name in it in newspapers back home on a daily basis and put it on the desks of the senators or representatives. So when you're writing that letter, you know, call on them and include their actual name and make it a really specific thing about making the priority on, you know, tax credits for low-income working families. And you can even include, you know, urging them to embrace bipartisan efforts to expand the EITC to children, workers without children. So we have lots more tips, both on, you know, the kind of what's happening and information you might want to include in your letters, and also tips to help make a get a letter to the editor published on our website. And in addition, I urge you all to kind of circle back with your group briefly and touch base on, all right, who reached out to the editorial page editor earlier this fall, you know, when the census data was coming out. This is a great time now to follow up with them, and we also have some resources to help you with that, which you will make sure you get offline. But again, make sure somebody's circling back, especially if you've been in conversation with editorial writers. So with that, I know often we typically do what's called a roll call section, and I do hope folks will make sure they're clear how many letters the editor, your group, will be submitting. But given we wanted to spend lots of time with Jared, which I think was a really good use of our time, we're going to go right to the share section. And so our fabulous New England-based organizer, Christy Martino, is going to facilitate that. Christy, are you there?
Can you hear me?
No, we can. Go ahead.
Okay, great. Thanks, everybody. Glad to be here. And I just want to say congratulations on all the hard work you guys did on the campaign trail. So let's hear a few of those stories of the successes that you had. We're going to start with Sandy Duckert from Results Albuquerque. Sandy, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
All right, go for it. Yeah.
Well, a couple of weeks ago, I had to drop some things off at a friend's house. And as I was driving out of her subdivision, this being before the election, I saw a home with lots of Democratic political signs and cars parked in front of it. And it was a Democratic early vote rally. So what to do? We'd been practicing our epic talks about tax policy for some time and looking for opportunities to talk to our legislators, but had been disappointed because we hadn't found any. So I decided there were about 80 people there, it looked like, and there had to be at least a couple aides from offices. So I crashed the party, and it turned out that our Senator Tom Udall and Representative Ben Ray Lujan, who were running for re-election, were expected and came. I listened to the pep rally, and as the crowds around our senator and representative cleared away, I got a chance to talk with each of them about the tax policy. I also know that Senator Udall is planning, or was, he probably still is, planning to introduce what's called the Song Act, which will try to streamline and strengthen government assistance programs. So I talked with both the senator and the representative about the need for finding a comprehensive and gradual step-down way to implement these programs to really help hardworking families get off assistance rather than lose benefits because they get a small raise and then fall off because they don't get other benefits they need. So it was a really low-key, fun exchange with each of them. Here in New Mexico, people wear blue jeans and cowboy boots to these kinds of things, so it was very, very relaxed. And I'm really glad I crashed the party and that I left just as the police were raiding it. A number of the neighbors had complained about the noise and the number of cars in the area. It kind of reminded me a bit of my younger years in the 1960s when we could crash a party and get some FaceTime with the people we wanted to see and then sneak out before the police came. So I love the serendipity of it.
Thank you so much, Sandy. And I always support a party crasher, so that's great. Thank you so much. So next we're going to hear from Susan Rack. She's a results volunteer out in Bernardsville, New Jersey. Susan, are you there? Susan? Susan, okay, we'll come back to you after we head over. We're going to go straight to David Tate, who is a results volunteer out of Northern Virginia in Arlington. David, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi, everyone.
Hi, go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to share with you a recent experience our group had with a congressional candidate. It all began with handing out assignments following the Saturday results call that pointed out the importance of establishing early relationships with potential congressmen. I volunteered to contact Don Beyer, who is running to take over the seat of a retiring Congressman Jim Moran. One of the group members was familiar with his website, so that's where I started. As it turns out, he was holding a forum on poverty within the next week. This, of course, was ideal for our purposes. There was no address for the location of the forum, only an email to request an invitation. I suspected there may be some screening process involved, so I described results and noted that we have partnered with such notables as Muhammad Yunus, Jeffrey Sachs, and Tavis Smiley. We got a positive response and eventually RSVP'd that we would have 4 attendees. We all went armed with our questions and potential techniques for getting noticed. As it turns out, getting noticed wasn't a problem. The forum was a small affair, perhaps 35 people snuggled into someone's home. We were one of the first to arrive, even before candidate Don Beyer. When we did arrive, we could not avoid bumping into him given the on-team venue. We had a chance to introduce ourselves and the mission of results. The forum consists of 4 fantastic panelists, and to say that we had front row seats would be an understatement. We were literally shoulder to shoulder with the panelists. We got in 2 questions relating to EITC and the importance of providing health care to people in poverty. Don Beyer indicated that maintaining and expanding EITC is his top priority, and he recognized that we need to make additional progress to expand access to health care. After the forum ended, our group was one of the first he addressed. Actually, he couldn't have exited the room without passing through the human barrier that the 4 of us presented. We were able to provide additional details about results. He was impressed that we were all bound with us on issues of poverty. We were also able to talk to his campaign manager, who will be his chief of staff. She indicated that after the campaign, she has a lot of work to do as far as understanding all the public policy issues, and she would welcome our help on the issues relating to alleviation of poverty. By the time the evening ended, addressing the candidate as Mr. Beyer just seemed too formal. As we left, it was, "Thanks for the wonderful evening, Don."
That is fantastic, David, and I think you guys are really going to be a fantastic resource, so good job on that. So
thanks.
I want to give Susan another chance. Is Susan on the line, Susan Rack? Okay.
Jenny, do we have Bernardsville on the line?
We do, and that line is open.
Can you hear me?
Yes, go for
All
it.
All right. Thank you for this opportunity. I attended election leadership meeting at the Jewish Federation of Greater Metro West New Jersey. They were hosting 3 candidates to speak on issues that concern them, one of which was SNAP. Mark Dunek was the Democrat running against Representative Frelinghuysen in the 11th district. Representative Frelinghuysen declined the invitation to speak. Janice Kovach and Leonard Lance were both there, and I asked all 3 of the present candidates what they planned on doing regarding strengthening and expanding the EITC and the CTC. I was rather disappointed that they simply expressed their concern for the poor and weren't at all interested in committing to any action. But I did give them information that I had printed for them to take away with them about EITC, CTC, and also I alerted them to watch for the Financial Security Credit Program. I asked Mr. Lance particularly to give his rationale for finally voting to cut SNAP after thanking him for meeting our results team personally in D.C. last June. He stated that the program had become too expensive, and so I followed up to remind him that this was a very responsive program that only increased in its price tag as poverty increased, and that it had a negligible fraud rate. I spoke with him briefly after the meeting broke up. But the most important contact I made there was with Melanie Roth, who is the director of the Community Relations Committee at the Jewish Federation. She's very involved in SNAP with a group of people that had just finished doing a SNAP challenge. And so addressing hunger was an issue that she was very interested in speaking with me about. She asked me, where did you get the information about Leonard Lance's record? And, of course, I told her from results and subsequently emailed her asking if she would like to learn more about results. And I have not yet received an email response, but I will follow up with her if I don't within the next few days.
Thank you so much, Susan. Thank you for your tenacity. And that sounds like a really great outreach opportunity in New Jersey. So thank you all for the shares. That's really great news, great work. And now we're going to turn it over to Jen for fundraising and announcements. Jen?
Oops, sorry, just getting off mute. Hi, everyone. This is Jen Paprotna, the Development Manager for Results. This was a great call so far. And I just want to wrap it up with a few things on fundraising and then some announcements. So just on fundraising, as you guys know, we can't do our work without that pesky thing called money. And I just want to know, let you know that for years, what you guys have done to support us is immensely important. You are our loyal donors, and you've held fundraisers. You've gotten new donors to learn about results and give. And individual donations provide critical funding for the organization. They let us support our staff, our website, these conference calls, the international conference, all the materials we can send out to you, our lobbying work, really everything we do is supported by individual giving. So on that note, I want to let you know that there's a few more opportunities still this year to join us in fundraising. One is to host an event, and if that works for your group and there's still time to hold a small holiday house party, we are happy to support you doing that. I want to give a shout out to a few events coming up. Santa Fe, which is tomorrow, so really excited about that. And then Detroit, Houston, Austin, and Seattle are coming up November and December. Another way you could help is by doing a friends and family campaign. And I like friends and family because it helps me talk about results to people. I kind of have an excuse to talk to them about our work rather than just like sit them down and tell them everything I do all the time. And I give them a chance to give to results. And remember, giving makes you happy. That's why you donate. It makes you feel good. So I think of it as when I ask someone to donate, I'm giving them the chance to feel good. And that makes me feel good. Our goal this year is to raise $25,000 through friends and family. And we're about halfway there. Thank you to a few groups and people that are have current friends and family campaigns ongoing right now. That's Dallas, D.C., Asheville, and Cindy Levin is doing her own with her daughters. If you're on Facebook, you can see just how adorable that is and how interesting she's doing it by herself. Now, we have resources to help you with all types of fundraising, whether it's a friends and family campaign, a virtual campaign, if you want to do a holiday run and have people donate to results for, you know, a turkey trot or a, you know, jingle run. Or if you want to host an event, we can help you definitely put on a successful house party or event still this year. And so that's all on the slides, and you know, contact me or Jen DeFranco to help you get started. And now I just want to close the call with a few announcements for you. So if you live in an area with no results U.S. poverty groups, please join the next results U.S. poverty free agents call, which is on Tuesday, November 18th at 1 p.m. and 9 p.m. Eastern. Also, introduce results to someone you know by inviting them to join the next results introductory call, which is this Wednesday, November 12th at 9 p.m. Eastern. There's a link in the PowerPoint slide for that. And then remember, we're very excited that the next Results International Conference is next summer. It's July 18th through 21st, and it's a big one. It's our 35th anniversary, so we really hope we see everyone there to help of making a change in the world. We'll have more details and registration information for you soon, but definitely start planning for that in July. And remember, you can find all the details from the events, the updates, the phone numbers for all the conference calls coming up on the results events calendar online. So thank you so much for being on the call today. Remember, the next call will be in December, December 13th at 12:30 p.m. Eastern. And just on behalf of everyone at Results, I get the honor to wish you all a very happy Thanksgiving holiday. And we want to let you know just how incredibly grateful and thankful we are for you. And I know everybody in the Results staff will be saying a word of thanks on that special day for you. So now, operator, if you would please open up all the lines, we could all wish each other a very happy Thanksgiving holiday.
Thanks, Thanksgiving.
Thank you. Bye. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you.